Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, we open our show with some breaking national news from Public News Service, including the indictment of President Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, on felony criminal charges that include conspiring against the United States. Public News Service also has an update on Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria and some tips for parents of trick-or-treaters on Halloween. Here in San Diego's East County, the Hollywood Casino in Jamul has been granted a permanent liquor license over the objections of neighbors and some public officials. Hear reactions from the tribal leader and opponents on today's show. The children's health care program in California is on track to go broke by December due to Congress failing to renew the program, and we'll have details. A new survey of local residents finds attitudes are changing toward immigration, with more San Diegans voicing empathy for immigrants and concerns over harsh deportation policies and spending large sums to fund a border wall. Santee will soon have its first movie theater. The council has approved a multiplex complex, including widescreen viewing options and more. Mercury Insurance is taking its case against California's insurance commissioner to the Supreme Court. Hear why he's confident California will prevail on today's show. Domestic violence is on the rise in several local communities. Stay tuned to hear the statistics and find out how you can get help to escape domestic abuse. Find out how you can help the homeless with a food drive for the holiday season. And then on Green Scene, hear why the National Park Service wants to double and triple park entry fees and how you can submit your comments on this controversial proposal. Local winemakers are hosting a Wine Aid fundraiser to help winery workers burned out in the Northern California fires, and we'll have information on how you can help later today. On sports, hear about a new lacrosse team coming to town, the San Diego Seals, a name that honors local marine wildlife as well as military heroes who train here. On the second half of our show today, just in time for Halloween, we'll be sharing some haunting East County ghost stories. Plus, hear about the latest San Diego Press Club Awards won by our reporting team right here at East County Magazine. So stay tuned for all of these stories on the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
This is a Public News Service Daily Newscast update for Monday, October 30th, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. The day's breaking news, Paul Manafort, the ex-Trump campaign chair, indicted for conspiracy against the United States. Also on the rundown, moves to cancel a controversial power contract to Puerto Rico. A company gives union members an ultimatum, get a shot or get fired. And some tips on why too much sugar at Halloween is hardly a treat. Our top story, various network newsrooms confirming the indictment of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, along with his longtime business partner, Rick Gates. The Washington Post reports a 12-count indictment includes charges of conspiracy against the United States, conspiracy to launder money, and making false statements. The Post says Gates did not respond to requests for comment, nor did a spokesman for Manafort. Likewise, as of this hour, no comment from the U.S. Justice Department. Puerto Rico's electric power company, known as PREPA, moved to cancel a controversial contract with Whitefish Energy on Sunday afternoon. Rebuilding Puerto Rico's electrical grid the way it was and carrying over its debt would leave it vulnerable and slow recovery efforts by years, according to a new analysis. The Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority was already $9 billion in debt before Hurricane Maria all but demolished the island's transmission system. Kathy Kunkel with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says PREPA was wasteful, badly managed, and imported all its coal and oil to generate power. She says it would make a lot more sense to build a decentralized solar system rather than reconstruct a grid that's susceptible to other storms.
If all they do is just rebuild the long high-voltage transmission lines and the old generation that previously existed. The solar industry, there are a lot of companies besides Tesla that are looking at Puerto Rico now and saying we can do this better.
solar power and battery company Tesla says it could build a renewable system for the island. Ohio is making strides in fighting poverty, but Mary Sherman says a new report warns that progress could be undermined by proposed cuts at the federal level. The number of Americans who favor the death penalty continues to drop, with a new Gallup poll finding the level of support at its lowest point since 1972.
The same survey that recorded 60% in favor of capital punishment last year found support had declined to 55% this year, with that number dropping to 39% for Democrat voters. Kristen Collins at the Center for Death Penalty Litigation in Raleigh says society is beginning to understand that a death sentence isn't always the worst punishment.
Being against the death penalty doesn't mean you're against punishment for people who commit murder. It means that you see that there are other equally effective, maybe more effective ways to keep our society safe and to punish the worst crime.
The last inmate was executed in North Carolina in 2006. Critics of the punishment point to examples of wrongful convictions and instances of mishandling of evidence. Supporters say it's needed in the most heinous of crimes. This is Stephanie Carson reporting.
And finally, Mona Shan tells us, as goblins and ghouls prepare to hit the streets for trick-or-treating, health experts say it's important to think about just how much sugar they're consuming on the holiday and every day.
Added sugar is hiding in many of the processed foods and beverages kids and adults eat regularly, with Americans taking in an estimated 20 teaspoons of it per day, more than five times the recommended amount. Stacy Sawyer with the American Heart Association in Michigan says when you throw in Halloween goodies, the health effects can be quite scary.
You put candy on top of it, you are just in a sugar overload. And sugar leads to a lot of health problems, including obesity and diabetes, and that can lead to cardiovascular disease.
In the past few years, more families in Michigan and across the nation have opted to hand out non-food treats at Halloween, such as small toys and games. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The Hollywood Casino in Hamul has been granted a permanent license to serve alcohol by the State Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control's Administrative Law Judge Adam Berg. The ruling came over the objections of Supervisor Diane Jacob, the sheriff, the Hamul Julzura School District, and many residents in rural Hamul. The decision makes permanent a temporary alcohol license granted when the casino opened about a year ago, but it also mandates the tribe continue its previously voluntary restriction to limit alcohol sales to between the hours of 10 a.m. and 1:30 a.m. In his decision, Judge Berg states that while opponents raised legitimate concerns with the impact the casino and alcoholic beverage service might have on the surrounding area, a preponderance of evidence established that granting a conditional license is not contrary to the public welfare or morals, he concluded. The judge rejected arguments claiming alcohol sales would increase traffic collisions on already dangerous Highway 94, create a nuisance to the community by interfering with schools, residences, and churches, or result in an overconcentration of alcohol outlets, among other points raised by opponents. Hamul Indian Village Chairwoman Erica Pinto issued this statement: "We are pleased that Judge Berg recognized our commitment to responsible beverage service and to keeping our guests and the community safe," she said, noting that the tribe has voluntarily limited hours of alcohol sales and committed millions of dollars to fund road improvements and emergency services, although not all of those improvements have been completed to date. Chairwoman Pinto added, "Furthermore, we are grateful Judge Berg saw past the opposing attorney's attacks on our tribal sovereignty and right to exist. Our ancestors have lived on these lands for 12,000 years. Judge Berg's recognition of our sovereignty is a sharp rebuke of the unfounded accusations that our opponents have tried to label us with for years," she concluded. Supervisor Diane Jacob voiced disappointment over the ruling. "This decision is a big slap in the face to the community," Jacob said. The San Diego Union-Tribune reports, "The fact is that this big bad mistake of a casino has made driving on the dangerous state highway even more risky," the supervisor said. On the Hamulians Against Casino Facebook page, several residents also expressed frustration and suggested the process was corrupt. Jackie Penner concluded, "Money and greed win over public welfare." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
It's been almost a month since Congress let funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program run out, and now the state of California says the program known as CHIP will go broke by the end of December. The California Department of Health Care Services says this unprecedented situation will require some hard decisions in November. Tricia Brooks with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families says Congress's inaction has forced many states to consider freezing enrollment or cutting benefits.
States cannot wait until they run out of money to take action. In fact, doing so would be irresponsible. But making changes to CHIP coverage, even temporarily, takes time and will further deplete the funds that states have to pay for health care for children.
Meanwhile, Brooks says lawmakers in D.C. have spent the past few months trying to repeal the ACA, pass a budget, and work on tax reform. California's CHIP program, which is part of Medicaid, has about 1.9 million children enrolled. The state is required by law to keep the program going, so some federal money would still flow, but the federal reimbursements would drop by 38 percentage points, leaving the state to try and absorb the rest. Kristen Golden Testa with the Children's Partnership says another program that covers 118,000 women and their newborns is entirely dependent on federal money, so the state would either have to end it or cover the cost.
It's a difficult situation because they have to balance being responsible program operators with not wanting to unnecessarily distress the families whose children depend on this coverage.
Two committees in Congress have already agreed on CHIP policy going forward, but they haven't figured out how to pay the $8 billion to fund the program for the next 5 years. Testa says the worry is that people will stop bringing their kids to the doctor even while the insurance program remains intact. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A new survey of nearly 900 likely voters from San Diego County reveals that San Diegans have more favorable views towards immigrants and immigration policies than they did 10 years ago. According to the survey released by Alliance San Diego, 60% of voters agree that immigration helps San Diego County more than it hurts, which is up from 54% 10 years ago. An even larger majority of county voters, over 70%, believe that immigrants have a strong work ethic, have strong family values, and are good neighbors. Nearly all voters surveyed, 96%, are aware of the Dreamers, the young undocumented immigrants who are now in jeopardy with the ending of the DACA program, and 82%, up from 75%, agree we should allow them to gain permanent legal status if they were brought to the U.S. as children, received a U.S. high school degree, and have no criminal record. 64% of San Diego County voters also oppose more walls and more ICE agents, while 74% oppose more detention beds. In addition, voters across the political spectrum overwhelmingly oppose the extra powers that Department of Homeland Security's ICE and Border Patrol agents have, and 83% agree that they should be required to follow the same rules as other federal, state, and local law enforcement officers by having probable cause or a warrant before entering private property, searching a vehicle, or detaining someone. Despite anti-immigrant actions of the Trump administration, including mass deportation efforts, the survey also found that a strong majority of voters locally, over two-thirds, in every congressional district in San Diego County, favors a pathway to citizens or earned legalization for undocumented immigrants. A majority of voters in all five local congressional districts also favor issuing more family visas and refugee settlements, and 75% or more in every congressional district favor work permits as well as fully staffed ports of entry. The survey was completed October 1st by the research firm of Fairbank, Maslin, Mollen, Metz, and Associates. Andrea Guerrero, executive director of Alliance San Diego, says San Diego voters consider immigrants to be good neighbors with strong family values and a strong work ethic. They support the DREAM Act and reject the extreme policies from Washington, D.C. to build more walls, hire more agents, and build more detention centers. She notes that while the issue of immigration sometimes divides us, voters are united across the political spectrum in opposing excessive powers that Homeland Security asserts to act against citizens and immigrants alike without a warrant inside the United States. Guerrero adds, "We urge lawmakers to listen to the voters from the largest border county in the country and limit the powers of DHS, which are far greater than any other local, state, or federal law enforcement agency, and undermine our civil liberties." Laura Moreno, chair of the San Diego Immigration Rights Consortium, made the following statement. "San Diegans have spoken, and elected officials should listen. The vast majority of voters want Congress to put forward policies of inclusion, which bring people together, not policies of exclusion, which devastate families and divide our communities." The immigrants' advocate concludes, "San Diego is a welcoming place for immigrants and refugees, who are contributing members of society and essential to the fabric of our communities. We call on elected officials to align with the majority of voters and advance humane and common sense immigration policies." Reporting for East County Magazine, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jean Carpenter.
For years, Santee's only movie theater has been an old drive-in theater. But last week, the Santee City Council approved a proposal by Cinemark to build a multiplex theater complex that will include a large format auditorium with a 70-foot screen, digital projection with 3D capability, and XD Extreme Digital for large format movies, in addition to showing movies in multiple theaters. The large screen space can also be used for community events or showing performing arts such as ballet or opera from other theaters. The new theater complex will also be equipped with comfy lounge recliner seats with footrests, a full bar and lounge seating, food delivered to theater seats at the start of showtime, an expanded menu of casual dining selections, as well as concession options ranging from Starbucks to craft beer. There will also be a party and event room suitable for community events or children's parties. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ in Santee, this is Miriam Raftery.
Mercury Insurance Company and a coalition of insurance industry groups have filed a petition against California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones in the U.S. Supreme Court, again challenging his authority to protect consumers from excessive and unfair insurance rates. Commissioner Jones says consumers should be angry but not surprised that Mercury and other insurers are continuing their attempts to unravel the long-standing consumer protections against unfair and excessive rates established by Proposition 103. He adds, "We have vigorously fought every attempt to reverse those consumer protections, and I will continue to do so." Since California voters passed Prop 103 nearly 30 years ago, Mercury and other insurers have filed lawsuit after lawsuit in unsuccessful attempts to weaken or eliminate the protections provided under the law and limit the commissioner's authority. Mercury's new assault on consumer protection comes after its failed request in May for the California Supreme Court to review an appellate court decision which upheld the commissioner's authority to protect consumers from excessive rates under Prop 103. In the California Court of Appeal opinion in March, Mercury and other insurers fought unsuccessfully to prevent Jones from forcing Mercury to reduce its homeowner insurance rates back in 2012. Mercury claimed it had a constitutional right to charge consumers for costs of its brand name advertising that only benefits the insurance company's shareholders. The appellate court upheld Commissioner Jones' rate order prohibiting Mercury from requiring consumers to pay $2.8 million for that brand name advertising, which did not provide consumers meaningful information about the insurance products sold. The Court of Appeals also rejected Mercury's arguments that Jones's rate order was unconstitutional, concluding that some of the insurers' arguments amounted to little more than hocus-pocus. The state Supreme Court refused to review the appellate court's decision. In its petition now to the U.S. Supreme Court, Mercury appears to have dropped its efforts to charge consumers for its brand name advertising. Instead, Mercury asserts it has a constitutional right to a guaranteed profit on its insurance products at the expense of consumers. But Commissioner Jones contends no private company has a constitutional right to a guaranteed profit. He says his role as insurance commissioner is to ensure that insurance rates are not excessive to consumers or inadequate to cover the cost of insurance, adding Mercury's rates were excessive. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jean Carpenter.
Last week, victims of domestic violence held a hope rally in El Cajon to draw attention to the problems of domestic abuse locally. Domestic violence impacts over 16,000 victims a year in our region, scarring families and sometimes claiming lives. The San Diego District Attorney's Office has provided statistics on domestic violence incidents locally.
Countywide, the number of incidents has dropped 5% over the last year. But some communities saw disturbing increases, including a 32% rise in domestic violence incidents in Lemon Grove, 26% in Santee, and a 14% increase in La Mesa from 2015 to 2016. In El Cajon and the unincorporated areas of the county, domestic violence incidents fell slightly by 4% and 3% respectively during the same period, while the city of San Diego incidents dropped by 7%. But last year, there were 12 homicide victims reportedly killed by their intimate partners in San Diego County. For victims experiencing serious domestic violence, the time when they are considering leaving the abuse, taking steps to leave, and the months following leaving can be the most dangerous, so it's critical for victims to connect with a domestic violence advocate for safety planning and support, experts advise. If you are a victim of domestic violence, you can get help by calling the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which has confidential assistance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by calling 1-800-799-7233. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Waste Management of San Diego and the Mother Goose Parade Association have launched a non-perishable food drive benefiting the East County Transitional Living Center, a faith-based facility which provides housing to help the homeless and others in need. The holiday season food drive will run through November 15th, with local businesses serving as drop-off sites, and will culminate with food collected by Waste Management at the Mother Goose Parade on November 19th. Daryl Priest, president of the Mother Goose Parade Association, says, "We are thankful to be counting on Waste Management as a chapter sponsor of this year's Mother Goose Parade and thrilled to be joining them to address a very important need in our community." Christine Costa, municipal affairs representative for Waste Management of San Diego, states, "As a business partner in East County, we are grateful for the many local businesses and organizations who have joined our efforts so that we may address hunger in our local communities. What better way to welcome the holiday season than to come together as one to help families in need?" Community members wanting to donate food items may do so by dropping them off at Waste Management's El Cajon office at 1001 West Bradley Avenue from Monday through Friday between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. or any of these drop-off sites: El Cajon City Hall, the East County Chamber of Commerce, Santee Chamber of Commerce, First Citizens Bank on Main Street in El Cajon, or the East County Family YMCA in Santee. You can also bring your non-perishable food items to the Mother Goose Parade, which will be held in downtown El Cajon on November 19th. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Meridian Broadus.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. The public has until November 23rd to weigh in on a proposal by the National Park Service to hike up entry fees to $70 a vehicle at 17 of the most popular national parks, most of them in the West. At Yosemite, here in California, that $70 would mean paying more than double the current fee of $30 for a weekly pass, and at some other parks, fees would be nearly triple. Fees for motorcycles would rise to $50, and people coming in on foot would pay $30. The parks affected are Grand Canyon in Arizona, Yosemite, Sequoia, Kings Canyon, and Joshua Tree in California, Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado, Acadia in Maine, Shenandoah in Virginia, Mount Rainier and Olympic in Washington, Yellowstone and Grand Tetons in Wyoming, as well as Arches, Bryce Canyon, Canyonlands, and Zion in Utah. According to Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke, the entrance fee increases will help renovate the park's infrastructure, which has suffered from years of neglect and underfunding. Deferred maintenance is estimated at $11.3 billion, and yet park attendance has been breaking records in this 100th anniversary year of the National Park Service. Zinke says, we need to have a vision to look at the future of our parks and take action in order to assure that our grandkids will have the same, if not better, experience than we have today. National parks already raised fees recently, and more hikes could make these national treasures unaffordable and inaccessible to some visitors. Critics contend that costs of maintaining national parks should be shared among all taxpayers, not just seasonal visitors. They are urging Congress to take action to increase park funding. Ben Schreiber, senior political strategist at Friends of the Earth, issued this statement in response to the proposal to hike national park entry fees. Secretary Zinke's extreme price hike will make America's national parks unaffordable for millions of American families. The Trump administration is turning our national parks into an exclusive playground for the rich, he says. And the environmental leader adds, yet again, the Trump administration is prioritizing polluter profits over the American people. Secretary Zinke has given our public lands to oil companies, slashed budgets, and attacked the regulations that ensure taxpayers receive a fair price for their natural resources. While Republican leadership looks to slash taxes for billionaires, price hikes at our national park will hurt working Americans. Schreiber predicts that this could be the first of many new fees that will be pushed onto working Americans to fund those tax cuts, adding, we should help give breaks to families who want to go on vacation, not companies who want to drill. But the Republican-led Congress has made tax cuts a priority, aiming to slash taxes for the highest income earners while cutting many other programs, from food stamps to firefighting. So the odds of sparing national park visitors' hefty fee hikes may be slim unless the public speaks out. The fees would only apply during the five busiest consecutive months, May through September at most parks, but that's the most popular season for family vacations when the kids are out of school. If the fee hikes are approved, budget-minded visitors could travel in the off-season and could also still seek out some national parks that don't charge fees yet. Or if you want to visit multiple national parks in a single year, you could buy an annual pass for federal lands at $80, one fee that won't be going up. A public comment period on the proposed fee hikes opened October 24th and closes November 23rd. You can submit comments online at the National Park Service website, nps.gov. You can also contact your congressional members to ask that Congress take action to provide more funding to national parks from sources other than jacking up fees on the public to visit our public places.
San Diego County winemakers are pulling together to host a fundraiser to help winery workers who have been displaced by devastating fires in Northern California's wine country, as well as animals harmed by the fire. With recovery efforts underway in Sonoma, Napa, and Santa Rosa counties, the impacts of the firestorms are now being seen, and the number of displaced people is staggering. So, the Bernardo Winery in Rancho Bernardo will hold a wine and food tasting event on November 12th from 1 to 4 p.m., partnering with other San Diego County wineries and restaurants to support winery and vineyard workers and their families who have lost their homes or been displaced in these devastating fires to reestablish their households. 100% of the online ticket sales for Wine Aid 2017 will go to those families through a relief fund that has been established by the Sonoma County Grape Growers Association. At-the-door ticket sales will support the Sonoma County SPCA, which is offering no-cost veterinary treatment for burned animals and boarding for lost animals. Ross Rizzo, president and winemaker at Bernardo Winery, says, people forget how much work it takes to make wine. Early mornings, scorching heat, and long days to get wine to table. We appreciate the workers and would like to help them up north, wine country to wine country. Many wineries from across San Diego, including East County, will be participating in the November 12th Wine Aid event at the Bernardo Winery, which has been producing wine since 1889 and is the oldest continually producing winery in Southern California, keeping its doors open through its own tough times by making sacramental wine for churches and grape juice during the Prohibition era. More recently, many vintners here in San Diego County recall the 2003 and 2007 firestorms when some local vintners lost their harvests or even their homes. Now these local winemakers are giving back, helping winemakers in Northern California in their time of need. The Wine Aid event will include wine and food tasting, live acoustic music, and a silent auction. For information on where to buy tickets, you can visit eastcountymagazine.org and click our food and wine section. or check the hashtag WineAid2017 on Twitter for more information. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Valerie Watts.
This is Liz Albert with a sports report. As San Diego continues to pour cement over the gaping hole the Chargers left in San Diego sports, a lacrosse team enters the fray. The San Diego Seals are set for their inaugural season next year. The Seals, who were formally dubbed and given the logo Tuesday at a press conference at La Jolla Cove Hotel and Suites by team officials, will begin play in the National Lacrosse League in November 2018 at the Valley View Casino Center. "We wanted a name that was inherent to San Diego," Steve Govett, team president, said. "The Seals' name acknowledges the marine mammals that live along our coastline, and it pays tribute to the brave men and women who help keep us safe and protect our freedom." The expansion team is owned by billionaire and Alibaba Group vice chairman Joseph Tsai, who said earlier this year, "I have a strong passion for lacrosse and look forward to bringing the NLL to San Diego. Our team is committed to creating a fan-first experience and to being an integral part of the local community."
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride who never made it to the altar and died along the trail reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery, and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reached Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thief survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing the frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine. which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost fountain mine, wandering the dark desert nights, looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of three emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the three travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other two men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other two noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The two men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The two men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the three emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the third arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired two other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had three ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around, but he ordered the other two ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost 1 million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Kaweah Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and, after a fierce battle, annihilated the entire crew. The Kaweahs began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy, large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Kaweah did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it. Perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with a fortune in pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s, when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats, until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994 when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the Reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wild cat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wild cats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brooke, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal-black fur that she believes was a jaguar. I sure froze in my tracks, she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, Two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears, another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsung, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
East County Magazine picked up four more awards for online and daily news reporting at the San Diego Press Club's Excellence in Journalism Awards, bringing our total to 105 journalism awards over the last 9 years. Our editor, Miriam Raftery, won first place in public service reporting for an article titled, "Whitewash, County's Border Fire Report Ignores Serious Concerns Raised by Residents." Raftery and Paul Cruz shared a second place award for political reporting for a story with video titled, "Hunter Faces Tough Questions at Raucous Town Hall in Ramona." Rachel Williams took third place for her report, "A Revolution of Struggle Continues for Syrian Refugees in East County." Rebecca Jeffress Williamson, Jonathan Getz, and Raftery shared a third-place award for their story, "Parkway Plaza Evacuated, Car Show Shut Down Amid Unrest After Police Shooting," covering the civil unrest after the shooting of Alfred Alongo in El Cajon. Congratulations to all of our winners.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.